Welcome to the Edge Conservation Podcast, where we bring you the latest in innovation, insight, and effort on the front lines of wildlife conservation in Africa and around the world. I'm your host, Kira Dorian. Today, we are taking you back to Limpopo, South Africa, to speak with Gareth Norris, head falconer at the Wild Raptor Conservancy. Gareth, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kira, for having me on your talk podcast. It's something I've been greatly wanting to do.
Awesome. Well, we're glad to have you. So can you just start by telling us a little bit about yourself and how you became the head falconer at the Wild Raptor Conservancy?
Okay, well, it's a long story. I was involved in a major car accident where I was put into a coma for quite some time, but I recovered from that. And yeah, I've always had a love for wildlife. I started in 2001 working with birds of prey. Then I went to go work at Monte Cassino Bird Gardens, where I worked there for a long, long time doing my thing. And then I became a game ranger. And then I got back into the birds again. And this is where I am now.
Wow. What was it about birds of prey that drew you to them?
Oh, their power. Everything about them is so, so amazing. I mean, birds of prey are the masters of the air. We can learn so, so much from birds of prey. It's out of this world.
Give me some examples. Like, what do you see because of that power that we can learn from them?
The power of flight is amazing. And the strength they have is out of this world as well. And when you really get to work with the birds of prey and see them up close every day and you pick up on their personalities, yeah, the power they have, their vision, everything about them is amazing.
Wow. So in the area that you are, how do these birds play a part in the overall ecology? And what would happen if they disappeared, if they were gone?
Okay, well, birds of prey serve as barometers to how good your environment is doing, because they are at the top of their food chain. And with birds of prey gone, we would have rodents everywhere. We would have small birds everywhere. Pests. They're the best pest controllers out there.
And cheaper, too, I would assume, than hiring pest control.
Yes, a lot cheaper.
So I know that the conservancy doubles as both a rehabilitation center for these birds and an educational resource. So can you tell us a little bit about each of these branches and the work that you're doing there?
Okay, the educational side of things, we put on a show every day. It's an interactive falconry display where we educate the public on raptors and about them, and people take it in a lot better when they're actually seeing it right in front of their eyes, because you normally see raptors and the raptors are way up high in the air or on a telephone pole, but you never get to see them flying right up close near you. And the children go away smiling all the time from that. And yeah, now the conservation side, we're a rehab center as well. So birds, they'll go to a vet first, and then they'll come to us, and then we'll assess how well the bird does, and then we use falconry techniques to train our birds to, and then we release them back out into the wild. But not we've got to teach them how to hunt and survive on their own before we release them.
So let's talk about the rehabilitation piece first. How do you select a release site for a rehabilitated birds, and what factors are you taking into account for release, including you know, how do you know they're ready for that?
First of all, we put them in through exercise training because your raptors need to be faster than their food. They need to be more agile than their food. And they need to be more clever than their food as well. So before we enter them into the field, we focus a lot on the exercise training. So we get them fit, and it's like cardiovascular exercise. So we fly them every day, and then once we see their fitness is up, then we'll enter them into the field, hunt with them for a season, and then once we're sure that their success rate is high, then we'll unrelease the birds. And then the release, we've got to release the birds in a habitat that's suitable for that bird. And then we've also got to take into effect the time of year, because we're not going to release a bird in winter when it's cold and there's not a lot of food around. So we would wait until spring or summer to release a bird when there's an abundance of food. And then we've also got to take into factor other birds of prey in the area, because if there is other birds of prey of the same species in the area, they are very territorial, and they'll chase that other bird of prey away.
So forgive me, this might sound like a really dumb question, but if you're taking a bird out and hunting with them and flying them every day, how do they know that they're not being released? Like, how do they know this is my release date and now I don't have to come back? Or do you ever have birds that think, oh, yay, I'm released, and off they go?
Well, I wouldn't say when the latter never happens. I mean, we're working with wild creatures, and sometimes that switch just goes off in their head, and then they're like, yes, it's time for me to go. But it doesn't happen much. You see, we use positive reinforcement when we train our birds. Another word for it is bribery and corruption. We've got the food they want.
So then do you ever struggle to actually release them when you've decided they're ready? Do they ever say, yeah, I'm going to stick with the free food and hang out here?
No, but when we release a bird, we don't just throw it off the glove and say survive. What we do is we hack the bird back into the wild. So we're leaving an enclosure in the wild for a week, and then we'll open a door to that enclosure so it can come in and out whenever it wants. Then we still leave food there for it for like another month until it stops coming back. And then when it stops coming back, you know that bird is doing well on its own.
And are you able to track the birds afterwards to see how they're surviving and faring out in the world?
Well, we would tag the birds that we release. And then, avid bird watchers would spot the tag and then give us the numbers. And or in special circumstances, we might put telemetry on the birds. But that's a very, very costly thing to try.
Right. And are the numbers looking good? Like, what are you seeing based on that tracking from the rehabilitated birds that you release?
Well, we haven't released any birds yet. On that note, it's been a year since I've been here at Zibula today. Mm. So
wow.
The center's only been open for a year now.
Oh, I see. You're relatively new. So you're still in that rehabilitation process then, but this is the plan for what it will look like when you do release them. And so what happens then if a bird is not releasable? What if they have some kind of permanent damage?
Okay. If they have permanent damage, a perfect example of that is our jackal buzzard Sky. Okay. The tendons in her 1 foot have frozen, and we presume it's from electrocution. Okay, so she hasn't got any movement in that 1 foot. And what makes a bird of prey is they kill with their feet. Now, Birds of prey out in the wild have about a 30% success rate in hunting, all right? Now, you halve that because you've only got one working foot. And now we're not going to send her out into the wild with only a 15% success rate in hunting. So it'll be very cruel of us to do that. So what we do with her is we use Sky now, educational displays, which we do every day, and she does an amazing job, even with that one working foot. I mean, she blows my mind every time she's in the show, and you know, she's so, so good.
Wow. So, okay, let's talk about the educational piece and the performance aspect of this. So how many of the birds that you're rehabilitating also perform? And if so, how does the performance work that they do benefit them? I assume that the exercising is a part of that. Are there other parts to it that then will help them later in the wild?
Okay, our display birds are non-releasable birds.
I see.
You see, our rehab birds, we don't like to use them in shows or use them in interactions either, because we're focusing on those birds for release. So we don't like to use them in the shows, but in the shows we give our birds exercise every day. We fly them around. We make them work really hard for their food. And you see, a lot of the time, birds, if they come in at a young age and they're with people the whole time, they can become imprinted. Now, what imprinting means is it's like the same story as Tarzan. Tarzan was raised by apes, so he thought he was an ape. The same with these birds. These birds are raised by humans, so in turn they think they're human.
Right. And so how would that affect them then out in the wild? If you did try to release these birds, I understand that you don't, but if you did, they just wouldn't survive because they see themselves as human?
Yeah, you see, they'll see themselves as human. Okay, well, we can train them out to hunt and stuff for themselves. But then when it comes time to breeding, it becomes very complicated because they think they're human. And
I see.
They're looking for a human to mate.
Right, instead of a bird. That is complicated.
They're very territorial as well. So then they start chasing humans to get out their territory.
Right, because they think that the human is the,
yeah,
and the enemy, or not the enemy, but the threat. Right, that makes sense.
Yeah, and they don't really have a fear of humans, which all animals have, but being a bird that thinks it's a human, it's got no fear of humans. Yeah.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. So when you're doing the shows, what are the conversations about conservation that you're having with the people who come to visit, especially the children? Because I know that's a huge part of it, is wanting to reach the kids who come.
Yeah, you see, now when we take our kids on like a static falconry display, where we take the kids on a tour of our facility and show them all the birds, give them information about all the birds, well, what we're trying to create more is an awareness, because they can see the birds up close and they get spellbound by the information like we tell them, like owls can hear in 3D, and a peregrine falcon can spot a pigeon from 8 kilometers away. And
wow,
the strength of our big black eagle, Betty, she has got more than 700 pounds breakpoint pressure per each foot. And I mean, when I've got her on my arm, she could go crush my arm if she really, really wanted to.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's really amazing. And we try to ignite that passion in kids and that type of thing, because we also tell, like, the grown-ups as well about using pesticides and that sort of thing, because that leads to birds of prey dying in the end, because the poison will biomagnify and get stronger and stronger from each animal it goes to. So instead of putting down rat poison to kill rats, which in turn kills the owls, because the owls will go eat the dead rats.
Mm.
And instead of doing that, put up owl boxes in your garden. Get owls to control the rodent population. And all you have to do is put up a box, and I'm so sure that you have spotted eagle owls coming into your garden, because spotted eagle owls in the rural areas are nesting a kilometer apart from each other.
Wow. So it sounds like when you can have this captive audience, you're doing two things. You're letting them sort of fall in love with the birds as they watch what they're capable of. And also then, because they're a captive audience, you have the opportunity to educate them about choices and decisions they can make to help protect the birds.
Yes. And that's why we make it very interactive as well. I mean, we like to tell a few jokes during our shows as well and keep the people on their toes and always asking guests if they got questions to ask them. And I mean, I'm sure you've heard the saying that there's no stupid question.
Right.
And we like people to ask us questions all the time. And we just love that passion.
That's wonderful. So the Conservancy is relatively new, it sounds like. What prompted the creation of it? How did it come together?
Okay, well, the founder of the center, Ruan Buerta, he has actually got another center there in Dubai as well. Wild Flight Dubai. Where he's got a team up there, but he's more in pest control over there in Dubai. But then he phoned me early last year and asked me if I'm interested in this position, and I said, yes, I'll take it, no problem.
Wow. So you mentioned briefly that you were a ranger for a little while. How did that contribute to your feelings about conservation, and what kind of things did you see that you would want our listeners to know about?
Okay. I've seen some very horrible things, and I've had some amazing, amazing experiences. I mean, I can honestly say I'm the only person I know of that has been push-started by a wild elephant.
Wow.
Yeah, I used to drive a 1979 VW Beetle. I took it home the one day to our ranger accommodation, which was in the Pilensberg, and someone left the gate open. So an elephant got inside. And I was bringing my Beetle home, and then I was actually going to go and leave that day. So I pulled my Beetle in. I saw the elephant was far away, so I ran inside, got my stuff, ran outside. But now the elephant saw me as I was getting into my car. So he starts charging me. So I get my car into reverse. I reverse it up the driveway. And then I hit the drainage line, and my car stalls.
Oh, no.
So I've got an elephant charging me, okay? I've got an elephant charging me. My car is stalled, and now I don't know what to do. So I'm just sitting tight in my car. So this elephant comes and checks me out in my window. He nods at me, and I'm like, what? Then he walks up so close to my car. His skin scratches my car. The elephant skin scratches my car. He comes around the back, and he starts pushing me down the road. So what do? Put it in second, and I jump start my car. Yeah.
Wow. That's incredible. Thank you, elephant, for the support. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then the horrible stuff. I used to do a lot of walks there in Pilensberg, I did a lot of walks because we were getting to know our area, because we just started this new lodge, Shepherd's Tree Game Lodge in Pilensberg, and we were getting to know the area of our operation, and we were doing a lot of walks around, and twice it happened where I walked into Poets Drama.
Mm.
It's not something anyone wants to see.
No. So what happens? I mean, what happens? You walk into this situation, you see this rhino that's been poached. As a ranger, what do you do? What are the steps involved in a situation like that?
Okay. The first step is to radio or call the parks board and tell them, hey, listen, at this and this site, I've encountered an animal that has been poached, and yeah, you just give them the coordinates and then stay there until they get there. The anti-poaching unit will be the first ones there all the time.
Is that part of what brought you away from being a ranger and back to working with the birds?
Well, working with birds is like a drug. Once you're in it, you can't get out of it. And I started, and I mean, I was doing it from 2001 to 2009, and then I took a break and became a ranger. My lifelong passion that I always wanted to do when I was working with the birds, I was also studying my Fugasa levels, and yeah, then I decided, hey, listen, if I don't go for my dream now, I never will. And I went for my dream, and yeah, and I mean, the sightings were out of this world. I mean, I've seen a pack of wild dog run straight into a herd of buffalo, target a calf. And that mother protected that calf for 45 minutes from those wild dogs. And the wild dog were playing it like a chess game. Some were attacking, some were resting, some were attacking, some were resting. Then I've never seen it or heard this in my life before. But a young male lion came in onto the scene. And those wild dogs stood in a line and barked, just like regular dogs bark, at this lion. And then the wild dog thought about it, and they said, no, we can't take out a buffalo and a lion at the same time. So they ran away, and the mother and the calf went off, and the lion came in a semicircle. Now it was in front of them. So now this mother saw this. She ran up a hill. The calf was struggling behind. That's when the lion was coming for the kill. The mother saw this, ran down the hill, missed that lion by millimeters with her horns. And then the lion said, no, no thanks. The lion went off, and the mother and the calf went back to the herd. And I mean, the moral of that story is, what a mother.
Yeah, that maternal instinct. Holy cow. I mean, literally, like, that's insane. That, I mean, and you hear about it as humans all the time, right? That protective maternal instinct. But to see that, wow, live, and oh, that's amazing.
And it was right in front of me as well. And to see that as well is out of this world.
Yeah.
And I mean, the wild dog sightings were crazy. It's a part of my life I'll never, never forget.
Amazing.
And I'm the head falconer here and loving these birds with all my heart. And
I love that.
Phoenix, this Gabar goshawk we got in, I named him Phoenix because she was caught in a fire and her feet were badly burnt. So the name Phoenix, rising from the ashes.
Yeah.
I've taught her how to hunt, and when it reaches spring, I'm actually going to be releasing her.
Wow. So do you have a favorite? Like, is Phoenix your favorite? Or do you have one particular bird that is your best bird?
Well, okay. I just hope the other birds don't hear me say this, but
I won't tell the other birds, I promise.
Betty, our black eagle, our African black eagle, she is my favorite. Now, your eagle's pair bond in the wild for life. You can really call her my wife. Oh. And that's what we like to tell guests as well. that she is my wife, and your eagle's a one-man bird. So I'm her only trainer. So, I mean, even on my days off, I still go in to train her. And for 4 months, the first 4 months I was here, I didn't have a single day off because I was in there every day to spend time with Betty. And, yeah.
Wow.
That bird is doing so, so well now. And, yeah. And her personality towards me. I can even go in the enclosure sometimes. Every morning I go in there, I say, "Morning, Betty." And she starts chirping away at me. And it's a really, I can almost say it's a spiritual bond that me and Betty have, because that's what it feels like.
Aw, I love that.
Yeah.
You know what they say, happy wife, happy life, right?
Yeah.
So keep Betty happy.
Yeah, it gets pretty complicated when people ask me, am I in a relationship? I can't really give them a straight answer.
Yeah, that I can imagine it does. So do all the birds have unique personalities? I mean, do you see distinct personality traits in all of them, even like within the same species?
Yes. Every bird has got his own personality and attributes that you can look at as well. I mean, you can almost say it's like having a dog. You can have two dogs of the same species, but they'll have completely different personalities. And yeah, it's the same with these birds. I mean, I worked with quite a number of birds of prey in my life before, and we also used to have two rock kestrels here, Lenny and Apollo. I called it Lenny because, you know, it's a rock kestrel. Mm. So, after Lenny Kravitz.
Oh, my goodness.
And then we've got Apollo as well. And now these two birds, they fly, they're two of exactly the same birds. But the one flies so much more aggressively than the other one. One floats around like a little butterfly. And their personalities are so, so different.
Wow, that's so cool. So, Gareth, can you tell everyone how they can find more information on the Wild Raptor Conservancy and the work that you're doing? Social media handles, websites, how can they support the work that you're doing? Just tell us all that good stuff.
Okay. You can go to our Facebook page and our Instagram page, Wild Raptor Conservancy. And, yeah, you can see the pictures that we've got there. And you're more than welcome to come by our center here at Zibula. And we'll share our information with you. We'll share our love of the birds of prey with you here. And then you'll be able to come and see the birds of prey up close and personal. Ask us any questions. If we don't know the questions, we'll get back to you on those. And, yeah, but we've got a team of highly skilled falconers here. I just said to my colleague the other day, we have the best job in the world. And we really do, because to be working with these amazing creatures on a day-to-day basis and experiencing this sort of lifestyle, and we're in the bush as well, and it's amazing.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today, and thank you for the incredible work that you're doing for these birds and for conservation efforts. It's an honor to speak with you.
Thank you. It's been an honor to be speaking with you.
So I hope you enjoyed this interview with Gareth. I think he's incredible. And I love this quote by Melanie Driscoll. She says, "Birds are important because they keep systems in balance. They pollinate plants, disperse seeds, scavenge carcasses, and recycle nutrients back into the earth. But they also feed our spirits, marking for us the passage of the seasons, moving us to create art and poetry, inspiring us to flight, and reminding us that we are not only on, but of this earth." I hope you'll join us next week. Thank you for listening. Our show is produced by Eric Johnson, me, Kira Dorian, and Edge.